This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We are here and ready to discuss the important events of the week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello, good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Kieran Underwood.
Good to be here.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, another terrorist attack in Paris. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for a shooting last night on Paris's Champs-Élysées. This is just 2 days before French voters go to the polls in the first round of the nation's presidential election. Stephen Fleury talked about this on Trumpet Daily Radio show this morning. And for a summary of what happened, how this could affect French politics, we're going to go to our man in Britain today, Kieran.
Just before these terrorist attacks came out, Foreign Affairs was describing this French presidential election as the most remarkable in the Fifth Republic's recent history. So already they're saying because of these crazy candidates, because of Marine Le Pen, because of the newcomers and the outsiders and the establishment crumbling, that this was already the most remarkable election. Now, during the debates last night, there was a terrorist attack, and it was on one of France's most popular streets. This is on a street which is running to the Arc de Triomphe, which is one of the most famous tourist attractions in France. So this terrorist kills one policeman, injures another two. ISIS immediately calls and says it's their man, gives the name. And this is happening exactly while the debate is happening. So they get the news of it, and all these different candidates have their ability to say what's going on. And of course, Marine Le Pen, who's this outsider, who's been saying, we need to get rid of radical Islam, we need to do something about it. This candidate, she's been screaming about these things, she's anti-EU. All these different things.
Of these four candidates, she's definitely the one that's most closely associated with the anti-immigration, anti-Islam position.
Oh, very much. And so she's loving this. And the other contender, who's probably slightly more popular than her, but of course there's around four contenders who are pretty much neck and neck. But the most popular one at the moment, Emmanuel Macron, he comes out and he pretty much says nothing. He says at the end of the debate, after the attack, he says he warns France that they would have to live with the terror threat for years to come. So he basically says, well, we're going to have to put up with this. And my presidency is not going to change it. So that was a pretty weak response from him. And you could very, very easily see this terrorist attack helping Marine Le Pen, who's been talking about this for years and years, and her father has been talking about it for decades, even before her.
Yeah, so this, Stephen Fleury was talking about just the response in Germany, and you were mentioning that Foreign Affairs article, just how remarkable what's happening here, and we've followed this trend of across Europe. We definitely see it in France. The rise of these outsider parties, the upheaval of the long-standing order in politics in European nations. France is already moving in that direction. Stephen Fleury was talking, he was sharing this Spiegel article this morning on the Trumpet Daily Radio show, where Germany is essentially saying all four of these candidates that are in the running for French president are individuals that essentially have no business being the head of a nuclear-armed European nation. So we've already seen just how extraordinary the climate is politically within France. This exacerbates it. It really comes on the heels of several other attacks that have kind of put us in this position. And you would think that this would only exacerbate that trend.
Yeah, if you hadn't had the Charlie Hebdo attacks, if you hadn't had the that night where over 100 people were attacked. And then later you had, I think, in Bastille, where another 80 or so people died. If you hadn't had those, then this random attack last night wouldn't have mattered. But really, it's just another reinforcement. Right there, while they're debating, here you go, there's another terrorist attack for you. So Marine Le Pen can say, look, there's evidence, you know, right there. And everyone realizes right now. I mean, there's not a lot of times where everyone around the world looks at a presidential election apart from the United States and goes, this is going to be really impactful. Right now in the US, you have a lot of editorials telling you that this French election is going to be crazy, or the outcome could be. They still have hope for the centrist Emmanuel Macron, for him to get in. Even that would be a change. And he's the candidate, that centrist candidate who's weakest on security. People think he's inexperienced, not very capable of dealing with those international threats or the domestic threats. So really, any terrorist attacks like this is making him look weaker and every other candidate stronger.
It really seems like, just given the timing of this attack, so close to the beginning of these presidential election, this process, that the Islamic State is almost sticking it in France's eye. And they are. This really is a tremendous provocation. You would think that it's handing, like you said, handing Le Pen a certain amount of support. She's the one that comes out looking strongest. She's the one that comes out looking like the most capable of dealing with this kind of threat. Islamic State is itching for a fight, isn't it?
It sure is, but I don't think that they're really looking at the rational outcome of any attacks that they're doing. I'm sure they're not thinking that their grand goal is to elect Marine Le Pen with these ridiculous attacks.
Yes, because in some ways it always reminds me, I remember reading some of the history before World War II, where Hitler actually wanted to go to war with Britain about a year earlier than he ended up doing, because he knew Britain was gaining strength and he wanted to hit them while they were still weak enough for him to take. And so he keep making all this ridiculous demands of Neville Chamberlain, and Neville Chamberlain just keep giving in to him. And like years later, he was actually just like fuming that he wanted to go to war earlier, but Chamberlain, he just was a man he just couldn't pick a fight with. In some ways, it does almost seem like, because like some, especially some of these more radical groups like ISIS, it seems like they do want a clash of civilizations. I mean, maybe they're not completely logical in thinking that they could actually win such clash of civilizations, but you got to imagine some of them must be getting almost a little frustrated that like, this is like our fifth terrorist attack in France. It's like, yeah, what do you have to do to get them to respond?
Yeah. Well, it is definitely a situation that it seems every time there is an attack that it does push the needle a little bit further in this direction, that it does move Europe toward a greater radicalization in its politics. I mean, so much of what we're seeing, like Kieran mentioned, in European politics today has been the result of, if it's not one attack, it's this accumulation of attacks that we're seeing. And you see so much more of the European populace and the voters in so many of these European nations that are willing to roll the dice with a candidate that is untested, outside the mainstream, apart from the establishment that we've seen. So it certainly is intensifying this trend that we've been watching in Europe for quite some time. While we're on the subject of shootings, there was quite a horrific incident in Fresno, California. This one also seemed to have some religious motivation as well as racial motivation. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. There is actually a little bit of a similarity to this, to the other one, and just in the fact of like trying to pick a fight. And this is something that's motivated primarily by race, but actually also by religion a little bit as well. The shooter, Corey Ali Muhammad, conducted a series of attacks in Fresno, California on Tuesday morning, where he'd stalked three different white men through the streets of Fresno, California, and shot them. According to the police chief, he'd yelled Aloha Akbar before conducting these attacks. And then in the interviews after he was arrested, was actually just really lighthearted, like laughing and joking about how he there was this war between blacks and whites, and he was trying to further inflame it. Apparently, he said he'd been at least accused of shooting another man the week before, a security guard, and he knew he was wanted and decided he was going to take out as many white men as he could find before he was arrested. And now with the he does. His religion is somewhat strange. He claims to be a Muslim, though he also claims to pray to seven different gods and to practice voodoo, which is not something normally associated with Muslims. But the police investigation so far looks like he took a lot of his inspiration from the Nation of Islam, which is both Islamic and black supremacist. He's had several posts on Facebook about praising the founder of the Nation of Islam. And even peddling a conspiracy theory that the Nation of Islam teaches about Yaqub. It's their version of the biblical Jacob, who they claim was this like mad scientist who lived on the island of Patmos 6,600 years ago and genetically engineered white people to be able to take over the world, apparently them not having existed by that. But that's pretty standard. Amongst the 50,000 or so Americans who belong to the Nation of Islam, the shootings are a more fringe thing. That this guy had taken inspiration from this this really fringe theology, and had told his family members that there was going to be a race war, and that it was kind of his duty to get that ball rolling.
So this he just went out and said, "I want to kill as many white people as I can." Or white men, I guess, specifically. How much of this, I mean, obviously there's a lot of strange details about his religion and everything. How much did race play a part in this? How much culpability do, you know, the race war mongers that we've seen in the United States bear for this type of attack?
For this particular one, like I said, the security guard he was at least accused of shooting, he said he shot in retaliation for an argument. I mean, I guess he's admitted to it that he was in. But then the three men she shot this week was definitely to provoke a race war. I think in this particular case, the main one of the main culpabilities would actually be the Nation of Islam. And this is not. That's not necessarily a group that's endorsed by the American government or the mainstream media, obviously, but it is influential with about 50,000 adherents. And even though I don't think this man was an official member, he was definitely getting his theology about this mad scientist who engineered the white race to take over the world, and now he had to fight back if he was going to save the nation for some sort of government conspiracy. That's all things he read and learned about from the Nation of Islam organization. Mm.
Crazy stuff. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program. On Wednesday, we spoke about the vote this past Sunday in Turkey, in which voters awarded strongman President Recep Tayyip Erdogan substantially more power. A lot of people are pretty uncomfortable with what's happened here. A lot of people are saying this is the death of democracy in this crucial NATO nation. But Donald Trump, the United States president, publicly congratulated Erdogan. We learned this week that Erdogan is actually going to pay a state visit to President Trump in Washington very soon to talk about the implications of the U.S.-Turkey relationship. We're going to go to our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, so Mr. Trump is really breaking from a lot of consensus throughout the Western world. That is that this was a bad move for Turkey. Turkey's future to have Erdogan consolidate his powers, and it's kind of one that we might have been able to see coming if we even go back to the military coup that took place in July last year, because President Trump really did at that time, as candidate Trump, I guess, congratulate Erdogan of being able to smack down that military coup, saying that, you know, he should remain in power. And really, that was kind of the last opportunity for the secularists, at least was what they saw inside Turkey. They thought to remove Erdogan from creating this Islamist empire or Islamist regime, him at the head of it inside Turkey. And yet Mr. Trump said, hey, that was a good thing. It's a good thing he retained power. And now we have Europe coming out and saying that this election wasn't free and fair. It was an unfair playing field, or at least this referendum vote. And yet Mr. Trump says we're happy that he was able to grow in power, at least showing and even tweeting that he is has a favorable opinion of Erdogan and the rule that he now has inside Turkey.
So what does American support for Erdogan do for Erdogan and for the future of Turkey?
Well, it is really interesting. We have right now Mr. Mattis, the United States, one of the key military officials for Mr. Trump. He is in the Middle East. He just met with Sisi, Egypt's president, strongman there. He met with Saudi Arabian leader as well. He met with King Abdullah of Jordan. He's right today meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu, as well as Avigdor Lieberman, the defense minister here. And what we're seeing is, and a lot of commentators are saying, that Mr. Trump is trying to, has a foreign policy of shoring up allies or strengthening allies, people that could be used to further American interests in the Middle East, regardless of the way that they're holding on to power. In each of these arenas, whether it's Jordan, Egypt, Turkey now, or even Saudi Arabia, you have strongmen in power that, while a lot of them might have the support of the majority, they are kind of holding Islamists at bay. And yet, with Turkey, you have this opposite extreme where he is an Islamist and the secularists aren't able to voice their concern. And yet, maybe Trump is just out and about allying with strong men to see what he can get out of them or how they can partner up in the future. But Turkey is an enigma in the sense that he is an Islamist, wants an Islamist state where the other of those don't.
Right. It's a little bit hard to tell exactly what is the unifying factor in Donald Trump's policy, his foreign policy in these other nations. I mean, you could look at Turkey as an outlier. I think really you're trying to speculate just like about everyone else is, as they're looking at the way that he's handling Syria and the way that he's handling Egypt and some of these other nations that you're talking about. How do you predict what's going to happen here? And it almost seems like he's taking advantage of this unpredictability.
Right. That might be the point to all of this. And Mr. Michael Anton, he's one of President Trump's top foreign policy advisors. And he said the chief characteristic of Mr. Trump's foreign policy is unpredictability. That's the point. That's the point, because unpredictability, as even Carolyn Glick writes editorial just this week, she says that this has a great advantage, keeping United States enemies guessing, and at least to some degree how they'll respond to hostile acts really does expand what Washington can do to maneuver with these other powers. But what she writes is the very fact that he's unpredictable also is difficult for allies. Sure. How do they continue to support an American president when they look around and they see that, well, they just don't know how he's going to act? And this could backfire on President Trump, just this aura of unpredictability that surrounds his foreign policy.
Well, and specifically with respect to Turkey, I guess the additional cost, obviously, is the fact that it legitimizes this Islamist strongman, and it makes it so that he's less and less concerned about the way that he comes across to Western nations. He feels more and more empowered to do what he wants to do. Not that there's a whole lot slowing him down anyway, but getting a pat on the back from the most powerful nation in the world, that's certainly not going to slow him down.
Yeah, certainly. And it is kind of surprising because he is so, Mr. Trump is so anti-Iran because it's a theocratic state. At least he's mentioned part of that and how that, you know, you have this dictatorial leader in there who exports terrorism. Now, while Turkey doesn't do that yet, I mean, looking to Bible prophecy, we see that Turkey is not in any way a friend of the United States in the end. And Carolyn Glick is trying to look at this in her commentary this week and trying to understand what Mr. Trump's doing. And the best thing that she can come up with is maybe he's just biding his time. Right now, the United States needs Turkey as an ally, but maybe in the future, hopefully, he will change. And being unpredictable in the way that he is, he's going to change and support other leaders inside Turkey. But I mean, how do you do that now? Erdogan has, after this referendum, holds all the keys to power. He's already removed over 1,000 people from public service that were opposed to him. He's already given the smackdown on the military. They are not able to overthrow him when the military was the guarantor of the secular state in Turkey for decades, having three previous coups that got rid of Islamist-leaning leaders. And now the military has been decimated and Islamists have infiltrated that inside Turkey and they all support Erdogan. So Mr. Trump's unpredictability might become backfire in Turkey because I can't see how Erdogan is going to relinquish control of that country.
Yeah, good points. Thanks for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We now have an update regarding the situation in North Korea. We are tracking the increase in tensions with this rogue Asian state, with the United States trying to prevent it from advancing its weapons capability, China looking like it's beginning to withdraw some support from North Korea. Well, this week, another ingredient was added to the mix, and that is Russia. For this, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, there's been a whole flurry of military activity in Russia's Far East region this week. There have been a lot of reports from eyewitnesses that say that the Russian military is moving great amounts of heavy equipment toward its border with North Korea. North Korea and Russia do share a tiny little border just south of Vladivostok. It's about 100 miles south of that port city there in Russia. And now Russia is fortifying this border and monitoring it. And it's apparently because of the rising fears of a military clash between North Korea and the United States. Russia fears that that clash could happen. We've spoken, as you said, about those rising tensions on several recent episodes. And the threat really just seems to be growing each week. And now Russia seems to be putting kind of a contingency plan in place so that it'll be able to contain any potential fallout if a conflict there does break out. Residents and local media in Russia's Far East have said that for the last 5 or 6 days, there have been large military convoys traveling from more western parts of Russia to that North Korean border. There was also a video published by the local DVHab.ru news site. And that video showed a train carrying 12 tracked vehicles, including the TOR surface-to-air missile systems. And then the Telegraph also reported on this. They said that there have been video footage released showing armored personnel carriers and helicopters traveling to that border. So it all adds up to look like it's some pretty heavy equipment. There was a Russian military spokesman who said, no, this is all just part of routine exercises. But the residents and media that live in that region say that it's definitely not routine. This is beyond anything they've ever seen there in recent memory. And it's even being called mass troop movements by some pundits, although that could be a little bit of stronger language than is actually warranted. But this report follows reports from the South Korean media last week saying that China has moved an extra 100 to 150,000 troops to its own border with North Korea. So all of this just adds up to show that this North Korean tension really could potentially affect far more than just the United States and North Korea. This is a situation that is also of growing concern to Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and very clearly China and Russia as well.
Well, it seems like as much as there were people who were criticizing Donald Trump for trying to sort of improve relations with Russia. This is one more sign of just how the Russian-United States relationship, if there was anything even close to a honeymoon between these two nations, that is not going to happen.
Yeah, I would say you could definitely view this that way. You know, of course, the Koreas have been home to proxy wars between the U.S. and the Russian or Soviet Union forces in the past, and there's been a lot of chatter and concern that it's beginning to appear like sort of a 2.0 version of that could erupt again.
Well, what do you suppose Russia has in mind? Is this kind of a defensive measure, just trying to keep themselves, make sure that they're at least prepared for any kind of contingency as we see these tensions rising and America's anti-missile system and North Korea threatening to strike the United States and who knows who else is there something more to it?
Yes, I think at this point it looks like for both Russia and China, the border fortifications that we're seeing are mostly defensive. There's a lot of concern that if the U.S. decided to take some sort of military action against the regime of Kim Jong-un, that the entire country could collapse, and that would probably very quickly lead to mass immigration. There would be a whole flood of refugees trying to go into any nation they could, which would include Russia on the north there of North Korea, and then China to the southwest. So I believe for the most part it's more defensive, but in situations like this, things can change very quickly.
Well, we appreciate that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about China's growing interest in the Middle East, Germany offering to send troops into Syria, an update on former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's re-election prospects, and how millions of millennials are living a life of leisure, no job, no school. Only problem is it's in mom's basement. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
In this second segment, we're going to focus our attention on the Middle East. The Middle East, obviously, very unstable region. And just think right now about the war in Syria, the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the ongoing existence of the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda. You have insecurity for Israel, Palestinian politics in turmoil, instability in several other nations. It's a diplomat's nightmare. Nations all over the world are trying to solve the various issues there, at least tamp down some of the hostilities. One nation you don't typically associate with Middle East peace efforts is China. But guess what? That could actually be changing. For this story, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, in the last few centuries, several of what you might call the great global powers have involved themselves deeply in the Middle East. We've seen the UK, France, Russia, and the United States all engage themselves there to varying degrees. And as you mentioned, each one was unsuccessful at bringing stability to the region. Each one of them became friends with a few Middle Eastern nations, but enemies with far more. And with China, though, it's been different. China was sort of a latecomer to the international system. It industrialized later than those other powers, and even after it had become a global player, China's policy of non-interference with other nations meant that it played only a marginal role in the Middle East. And so now, because of all this, China's in quite a unique position in the Middle East, and it's sort of trying to present itself as a friend to all Middle Eastern countries and an enemy to none. China's been able to walk the Israel-Palestine tightrope. It's been able to build pretty significant and close ties with both the Israelis and the Palestinians. Most every other nation on the planet has kind of had to choose a side, but China says, we choose both. And then it's sort of the same situation with Iran and Saudi Arabia. Those two powers have been locked into a fierce rivalry for many years, but China's been able to navigate that rivalry and become a really close partner with both Riyadh and Tehran. During the Iran-Iraq war back in the 80s, China was Iran's primary weapons supplier. And then during those decades when the international economic sanctions were in place against Iran, China's relationship with Iran continued to improve. They even gave them weapons a couple of times, anti-riot gear and things like that. And meanwhile, China kept on supplying all kinds of weapons to the Saudis, including a lot of weaponry that the U.S. refused to sell them because of concerns about Saudi Arabia's opposition to Israel. And right now, China's on the verge of buying the largest non-domestic share of Aramco, which is Saudi Arabia's state-owned oil firm. It's the most highly valued company in the world, if the IPO estimates prove accurate. And then in Syria, China's been able to support the regime of Bashar al-Assad somehow without damaging its ties with those nations like Turkey and Saudi Arabia, who really detest that regime. So China really is in a unique position. All of its partnerships add up to make it the number one exporter to the Middle East. It has a really deep and growing reach. And at least on the surface, it is kind of a friend to all of those nations. And now the Chinese leadership seems eager to use this sort of unique position to exert even more influence and just to expand China's power even more. A few months back, Chinese President Xi Jinping spoke to the Arab League, and he really tried to contrast China's approach to the Middle East with that of the other powers, mostly America. He said, quote, "Instead of looking for a proxy in the Middle East, we promote peace talks. Instead of seeking any sphere of influence, we call on all parties to join the circle of friends. Instead of attempting to fill the vacuum, we build a cooperative partnership network for win-win outcomes." End quote. So it all sounds pretty good, but of course it's all based on China's self-interest. And but it is clear, though, that rapidly rising China is just gaining more and more influence there, exerting more and more influence in that region, and it coincides with Russia's rising influence in the Middle East. So it really seems like all of this could just become one more factor that worries Europe in a way and prompts the European nations to lay aside their differences and unite so that they can stop sort of losing out to everything that's going on with Russia and China.
Well, before we get to maybe some of the follow-on effects and how that might affect Europe, just can you pinpoint some of the elements in Chinese self-interest that it really is pursuing here? Certainly there seems to be a strong economic incentive to do business with a lot of these nations. What else, maybe geopolitically or through power projection, would China be after?
Yeah, well, it is mostly about economics, just trying to boost China's market share everywhere possible. But geopolitics definitely factor in. In both Pakistan and Djibouti, China now controls major ports. In Djibouti, it's a full-fledged military base. So the Pakistani port gives Beijing access to the Strait of Hormuz and the Arabian Gulf. And then the Chinese presence there in Djibouti gives the Chinese access to the Bab el-Mandab and also the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. So some really vital waterways and strategic little passages there. So a lot of this really does seem to be positioning China in a way that it's able to navigate through some of the most important passages in the world. And that's for economics for the most part. I mean, these are vital to trade, but in a military situation, these passages would also become, of really vital importance.
The Trumpet has talked in years past about just how much resources are going to be the source of contention going forward. As you see, a nation like China, a huge, massive populous nation that is requiring more and more of the resources of the world in order to sustain itself and continue its growth, that there's going to be greater pressure on some of the world's resources, and especially as China is pretty aggressively reaching out and trying to claim its piece of the pie in some of these areas that maybe have quite a bit of resources to draw on. You mentioned Europe looking at this and being concerned about China's incursions in the region as it is with Russia, which we've talked about quite a bit. Do you know of the, say, tangible evidence of Europe being concerned about that, or is that at this point more speculative?
Yeah, I would say at this point it's just speculative, but you have to imagine that the Europeans see Chinese influence you know, rapidly rising in Latin America, in Africa, mm-hmm. and now in the Middle East on top of that. And in a lot of these regions, these are nations that the Europeans have historically had a huge stake in economically and very close ties with politically and economically. And so just to see that rising Asian influence, the Europeans would have to eventually say, we've got to, you know, take some sort of action to slow this, or else we'll be left without any of that, you know, the piece of the pie that we're losing out to them.
Yeah. Very interesting. Jeremiah's actually working on a pretty major feature story on this for thetrumpet.com and the print edition of The Trumpet. And so we look forward to reading that. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. We've been closely watching the war in Syria, and particularly it's heated up recently with Bashar Assad using chemical weapons on his people, Donald Trump sending missiles to degrade those capabilities. Well, this week, Germany called for the United Nations to send a mission into Syria once the civil war ends and offered to actually send German soldiers into that nation. Very interesting development here. For this, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Kieran Underwood.
Yes, the German defense minister said that she would send in troops after the civil war ended. But the real question is, I think, when will the civil war actually end?
Right.
I mean, that's the big question about for the timing of these troops going in. But what she really was trying to say is, we'll clean up the mess when it's all over and we'll rebuild the country. So usually we in the Middle East, we've seen the U.S. try to do the rebuilding. And of course, you have a lot of people mocking the neoconservatives for trying to rebuild every nation, rebuild Iraq, rebuild Afghanistan. And clearly, America hasn't done a very good job of it. But Germany wants to do it if Syria ever comes to an end. So von der Leyen in this German newspaper, which is called in English, The World on Sunday, she said, and it reported on April 16, that if we really want security for those of us in Europe and in our immediate neighborhood, we also need to be willing to give the structures in which we must the appropriate means to act. So she was talking about, we have to give the structures now. And she said, well, yeah, the German soldiers will be going, or they can go, if the UN is going to do this when it finishes.
Yeah, Germany always seems to present itself as a solution to a situation like this as part of European Union efforts. Or here they're talking about doing this under the umbrella of the United Nations. But still, quite extraordinary to see them talking about actually sending German troops into this area.
Exactly right.
Yeah, well, what I think is interesting about this is Germany seeing Syria, even as you quote that quote brought out, as its strategic environment. We've seen the expansion of Germany's strategic environment. They've used this same reasoning for its actions in Libya, its missions down the southern Mediterranean, that if we're going to protect ourselves, we need to be willing to pay and put boots on the ground to ensure that these countries can develop in a way that is good for Europe. And Libya, they've said that, and now it's Syria. I mean, and we've even seen this, I mean, the migrant crisis has shown that what happens in Syria does have ripple effects. And yet Germany, when you consider this, is going far from its national borders. Mm-hmm. Even their actions in Afghanistan, it's the same we've seen the same policy. So that's really something that has biblical ramifications. Germany looking far outside its traditional boundaries in order to project its power, to protect Europe, for it to be seen as the protector of Europe.
Yeah, you can go online to thetrumpet.com and look at this article that was put together by our trumpet writer, Josue Michels. It's called Germany Sees Itself as a Vital Part in Syria's Future. And obviously, German relations with Syria is something that we've talked about for a long time because of a prophecy in Psalm 83 about there being an alliance between these two among several other nations in a sort of Middle Eastern confederation along with Germany. But he quotes in that article Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury talking about Germany being involved in Syria. Syria's revolution isn't about a humanitarian crisis at all. It's about geopolitics and how Berlin can aggressively advance its strategic interests in the Middle East. So this is something that we've been watching for some time. To this point, Germany's response to the crisis in Syria has been relatively tame. But to hear Germany's defense minister come out and talk about actually putting boots on the ground in that country is quite an extraordinary development. Now we'll have another follow-up to a story we brought recently to you about the upcoming Iranian presidential election. We talked about the reemergence of former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who threw his hat into the ring in spite of having been publicly sidelined by the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, it didn't take long before Mr. Ahmadinejad's political fate was sealed. For this, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, this is an interesting story because it's one that we have been looking at, especially Mr. Ahmadinejad, and the fact that he surprisingly decided that he would go on the ballot, or at least try to go on the ballot. But the Guardian Council released their candidates for the presidential election, the six of them that's going to be on the ballot on May 19th. And Mr. Ahmadinejad, as well as his deputy, were rejected by the Guardian Council. It's interesting. Mr. Ahmadinejad said that he was going to try and be on it just in an attempt to provide some motivation for at least keeping his deputy there. But the Guardian Council, as proving who really runs the show in Iran, booted both of those men, those hardliners, from the ticket.
They weren't alone in getting kicked off of the ballot, right? It's a pretty tight race to make that kind of a cut from the Guardian Council.
Yeah, there were 1,600 people who applied to be president, and only six of them were chosen, as I was saying, by the Guardian Council. Again, half of that council is selected directly by the Ayatollah himself, showing just how much he does run the show there in Iran. There were 130 women that tried to make the ballot, but proving that the Guardian Council doesn't want a woman at president or a president of Iran, all of them were withdrawn as well, or rejected as well. So what's interesting is that the people that were accepted on the ballot, and it looks like what the Guardian Council has tried to do was consolidate the moderates or the reformers, if you like, behind Mr. Rouhani. He's already the president. He's the incumbent. He's running for a second term, and he was selected as one of the six. And yet the other five that are on there seem to be hardliners or principalists, which looks like it will dissipate that vote among the people, because the hardliners that would vote for one candidate that was a hardliner, if there was only one, they have now five to pick from, which could be seen as something that will help Rouhani retain the presidential office.
This does show Iran's true colors. As much as it's kind of made this reemergence into the international community, and there are a lot of nations that are acting like Iran is just one of the gang, that it's it has legitimacy as an international player. This shows it still is a theocracy. It is run by a man with the 12er Shiism version of Islam. We should know what we're dealing with Iran here.
Yeah, I mean, every single one of these candidates that's on the ballot, the Ayatollah is happy with. So they might have some of these presidential candidates might have a different way of supporting the Islamic revolution that they want to export throughout the Middle East and across the world. They might have a different way of wanting to do that, but they all do support the Ayatollah in their very fundamental level. And Iran is not going to experience a sea change, regardless who gets into power.
Thank you for that, Brent. This is Trumpet Radio on Trumpet Radio 101.3. We're going to finish here with a story about what sounds like, for a lot of people, the dream life. No job, no school, no boss, no bills. a life of leisure. Millions of millennials are doing just this. The only problem is they're not exactly independently wealthy, and a lot of them aren't living this way by choice. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, they just released a new census report this week entitled The Changing Economics and Demographics of Young Adulthood, 1975 to 2016. And that's where a lot of these statistics that are showing that amongst U.S. adults between the ages of 18 and 34, a full one-third live at home. And then it breaks down that demographic a little specific. Now, obviously, you'd see that some of those younger ones, the 18-year-olds, might be a little more expected if they're going to college or something like that. But amongst those between 25 and 34 for that decade who are still living at home, one in four is not working or going to school. Hmm. So they kind of have the life you've explained in the intro, to where it is like no boss, no bills. And just in you with your living with your parents, which, as this report points out, the changing demographics, that is a huge shift from the 1975, when obviously it was closer to maybe like 10 or 15%. I think it was 15% that still lived at home amongst that demographic. So over half over again. They said, I think this is one of the more recent reports where there's actually more millennials living with their parents than are living with a spouse, which is, again, a huge change from 1975, when the previous arrangement, living with your spouse, would have been twice as common amongst those between 18 and 34 as living with your parents would have been.
Any other details that we can tease out from the Census Bureau data?
The Census Bureau, it did really break down what they're saying, that roughly 60% of those living at home, not working and not studying, are men. So it seems to be something that's affecting the male millennials much more than female. And it is also a pretty big majority, like two-thirds, only have a high school degree or less. So they're not, I mean, that's one thing that you'd normally associate with millennials living at home, is just you hear these horror stories of people with huge college debts where their half their paycheck is going to just towards college loans, which is a problem. But it definitely seems like amongst this group living at home that the two-thirds of them, actually the college debt isn't the issue. They've just have the high school degree. Mostly male. They said half of those are white, which, considering that closer to like two-thirds of the nation is white, would make them slightly less percentage-wise than some of other racial groups to be living at home with their parents. But so that really just does kind of break down, giving a little bit more of a picture of the causes behind this. I mean, a lot of this is people are putting on to college debt, or to changes in the economy, with the economy moving from a more manual labor based, as was in the past, to a more high tech economy, people having a harder time finding work. Although you'd think, especially amongst the demographic that only has the high school degree, they're not burdened by college debt. We're getting reports coming out now where President Donald Trump's trying to do his Buy American, Hire American, and these American manufacturing companies have been lamenting the fact that they're having to bring over Asian exchange students to do those higher level engineering and technical jobs, because the American workforce we don't actually have enough. We're not actually producing enough like high skilled, like engineering or science and technology positions to fill the jobs available. You're thinking that we've got a pretty big reserve there of like over 2 million people living at home with a high school degree, mm-hmm. that just a 2-year stint at a technical college would, I know when I worked in research and development, a lot of the entry level positions that they were struggling to fill were just required 2 years at a technical college. If you had a little bit of an aptitude to do that, and parents who are paying your bills anyway, it wouldn't be wouldn't take too much creativity, you'd think, to get into something like that.
Right. Yeah, it does seem like people can point to a lot of different causes for this, and the changes in America's economy, and a lot of different factors, but it does seem like you can't avoid the fact that there are there definitely is an ambition gap with a lot of these younger people that just don't seem interested in assuming the responsibilities of adulthood. I'm just going to make a really shameless plug here for a new book that we posted on thetrumpet.com. It's called Biblical Manhood, and we talk about this somewhat. It's talking about seven roles that if you study the Bible and what God intends a man to do, one of those roles is the provider. And it seems like as society has obliterated the sense of responsibility in a lot of men to fulfill that provider role, that we see a lot of ripple effects that have come from that. And it seems to me like this is definitely one of those that we're seeing, that there's just a lot of young people who don't feel any real sense of duty and responsibility to step up and step into those, that role of making sure that they really are getting gainful employment, that that can be used to support a family and to build solid, strong families, and so on. You can find that on thetrumpet.com under the literature tab. Go check that out. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit thetrumpet.com. Can you find that book there for absolutely free. You can download the whole thing at no charge, but everything that we've talked about on the program, we try to get some kind of representation up on thetrumpet.com about these stories, and you can keep up with these and the latest of stories on all the regions that we talked about here. There's a whole lot there to check out, and we encourage you to do that. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention this week, and we'll start with Brent.
The ultra-Orthodox parties inside the Knesset are threatening to dissolve the parliament coalition of Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu after the Supreme Court passed a law allowing Tel Aviv businesses to operate on the Sabbath. Israeli law forbids businesses from operating during the Jewish day of rest, with exceptions including places of entertainment, restaurants, and basic services such as pharmacies. However, the Supreme Court decision will allow mini-marts to operate on the Sabbath, violating the day of rest. Now, this ruling was hailed as a victory by the city of Tel Aviv and its liberal politicians, who said it was an important step against religious coercion. But the interior minister, who belongs to the Shas or ultra-Orthodox party, says it was a serious blow to the holy Shabbat and the character of the Jewish people.
And now Kieran.
Prime Minister Theresa May announced that the United Kingdom would hold national elections on June 7. Her government has only a slim working majority of around 17 seats in Parliament, and this is out of 650. With Labour the main opposition party and turmoil, the polls indicate that a fresh election could give her a majority of over 100 seats. Her aim is to increase her party's lead and return to power ahead of a much, much more stable government, meaning an easier Brexit.
All right, we'll go now to Jeremiah.
Another shooting for the week, this one in Russia. Russia's FSB intelligence agency says that three people were killed on Friday, including the attacker, and another person was wounded in an attack on its office in the Far East. The FSB is the main successor to the KGB, and it said that an armed man somehow passed by metal detectors, entered the reception area of one of their offices there, and just opened fire on the people who were in there. We don't yet know if this was an Islamic terrorist attack or what the situation was, but these types of incidents very often open the door for President Putin to tighten his grip on power.
All right, now to Andrew.
Police in Cleveland, Ohio, went on a manhunt last Sunday for a man who committed murder, filmed that murder, and then uploaded the film onto Facebook. Immediately after doing so, the man also went on Facebook Live and bragged about committing several other homicides, which have yet to be verified. Facebook was unable to pull down the live broadcast in real time and failed to remove the murder video for several hours after the fact.
All right, back over to Brent.
After the attack of the United States in Afghanistan last week, the former head of Israel's foreign ministry and longstanding advisor to Benjamin Netanyahu, Dori Gold, wrote a piece for the Jerusalem Center of Public Affairs reminding people of Iran's role in the Taliban's rise. He wrote this. He said, the Taliban presence in Afghanistan is an opportunity we have to learn what are the exact relations between Shiites and Sunnis. The Taliban, of course, he writes, are radical Sunnis, and almost everybody who starts learning about the Middle East begins thinking that Sunnis are at war with Shiites. But then he goes on to write, in this case, we have the Taliban, who are Sunnis, being supported by and trained by Iranian Shiite forces. So he's basically blowing up this myth that Iran can't ally with Sunni forces around the world, which is very important because Bible prophecy does say that Iran will ally with some Sunni states, such as Egypt.
And now to Kieran.
63% of the Turkish citizens who live in Germany and were allowed to vote in the Turkish referendum voted to give President Erdogan greater powers. That means that even with the Germans' free press, those Turks still wanted to increase the power of their president back home. There are 3.5 million Turkish Germans who reside in Germany. But a Christian Linder, who is a German politician, said, those who live in a liberal country like Germany, who have decided to vote or restrict freedom in Turkey, have obviously not accepted our values.
All right, we'll finish with Jeremiah.
Russia's Supreme Court ruled on Thursday that Jehovah's Witnesses are now banned in Russia. They are considered an extremist organization, and they must disband, and they must hand over all their property to the Russian government. The Jehovah's Witnesses have said that they will appeal this decision, but religious life in Russia is just really increasingly dominated by the Orthodox Church. The church exerts considerable political influence. It also has the full support of Russian President Vladimir Putin, so I don't think that the Witnesses should be very optimistic about this appeal.
All right, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on today's program. Give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Kieran Underwood, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Lawrence Johnston Peter. There are two kinds of failures, those who thought and never did, and those who did and never thought. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.